Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters at Home. I'm Owen Wainhouse.
And I'm Tamsy Thompson.
And we're joined today by the Managing Editor of the Architects Journal, Will Hurst. Hello, Will.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Will. It's great to have you on. And I guess before we go much further, we should ask you to explain exactly what is a Managing Editor. What does that involve?
Well, I suppose it's probably a bit different on different publications and different kinds of publications, whether you're talking about magazines or newspapers, for example. I mean, in my case, I think it's a combination of different things. And there's obviously a fair bit of overseeing of editorial in the AJ alongside the editor, Emily Booth. So I do a lot of commissioning of articles, particularly opinion pieces. I do a lot of proofing of both AJ and AJ Spec, which is our monthly specification magazines for materials and products. And quite a large part of my role is involved in the more commercial stuff, so primarily events, of which we run many over the course of the year. Obviously, those are in a bit of disarray at the moment with coronavirus and other things, you know, that are more commercial, that go hand in hand with that, like sponsored content and commercial partnerships and competitions. So we've done several competitions with third party developers like Brick by Brick in Croydon and the Crown Estate. And luckily, my role still involves a bit of, you know, reporting, which is, I guess, the bit I'm most passionate about and the thing that made me get into journalism in the first place. So yeah, that's got a smaller and smaller, really, as I've got more senior, but I've still hung on to that, which I enjoy.
A managing editor then brings in some of the kind of the business angle as well as the journalism. You know, I guess people talk about the big changes undergoing the architecture sector. I guess media is another sector undergoing kind of huge business transformational change at the moment in terms of, you know, online publications and engaging audiences in new ways. You've obviously just put an issue out last week. Are you still, you know, in this new corona era world, are you still publishing? Are you going to be doing more online?
I think our plans are still to put out the print title and the digital product, the website. I think it does present challenges, the fact that we're all working from home now and have been for a couple of weeks. Obviously, we're struggling with some of the same things that other people are struggling with, I think, with many team members having children who are now home, and I can hear some in the background, in fact, and technology and all those.
That's mine.
That's yours, Tandy. You know, we're struggling with the same things that everyone else is, but I think our plan is to continue, and we put our first almost completely working from home issue to press recently, and it seemed to go pretty well, touch wood. So,
and how did that work out?
Well, I think the printers themselves are running a skeleton operation, so, you know, it was just a case of very quickly getting to grips with some of the technologies that you need. So if you'd have asked me a month ago, what is Zoom, I would have had no idea. But now, you know, we're all using Zoom and Teams and Slack and all the other slightly more traditional things that we'd relied on before, like email and telephone. So we're using a variety of things. And yeah, it seemed to work a bit more smoothly than I'd thought. But as I say, there are these other challenges in the background. And I guess as we go on, I have this feeling, we had an interesting comment piece written by Rab Bennett's, which you may have seen, which we published a couple of days ago. I think as we go on, we're going to see, unfortunately, more of this disruption, because yes, people can work from home, but the stuff that they are actually writing about, or we're writing about as journalists, is, you know, drying up. The work is drying up, and eventually Rab was predicting, you know, we're not going to have much building work going on, and when that happens, that has a knock-on effect on architects. You know, the planning system as well is finding it harder to operate, for planning meetings to happen. So, you know, unfortunately, we are seeing a quite a serious scenario emerging for architecture, I think, and just like so many other sectors, really. It's obviously the whole economy we're talking about. But at the moment, you know, I feel like it's a bit like when Wile E. Coyote runs off the end of the cliff and his legs are still going. He hasn't quite realised, but, you know, he's left solid ground.
What do you think that might mean for the magazine and the content? Does that offer opportunities as well as challenge for different types of content?
Yeah, definitely. I think it is, you know, it's obviously grim in many respects, but there are really interesting sort of challenges, I think, that it throws up, and challenges to the way we think and the way we operate, which will, you know, probably have some positive benefits as well, I should think. Once we get through all of this, people are going to think differently about all sorts of things, including building. And I've been talking to a public health expert called Professor John Ashton, and he had some really interesting things to say about this as well, that it's going to provide all sorts of challenges to the way we think about housing people, about offices and how much demand there is for offices, and indeed about sort of how we design with this sort of pandemic in mind. You know, actually some of the best principles of architecture, he was saying, are good at fighting the virus, like, you know, good ventilation, natural daylight. I'm not sure I was very familiar with this idea of how do you design for good hygiene, and I'm not sure if biosecurity was the word he used, but it's something like that. It's a very specialist field of design. Yes. That, you know, I was not familiar with until very recently.
And do you expect that there's any kind of changes, I guess, to people's living patterns or desires? We're talking earlier about whether people will be more drawn to move out of urban areas, and we'll be back to the 80s where this kind of desire to have urban living is somewhat diminished by being locked in for 3 or 4 months.
Because people see the downside of urban living and feel claustrophobic, do you mean?
Yeah.
That thought had occurred to me, and I don't know really. I think ultimately cities will still have much of the same pull. And we've seen a great urbanisation, haven't we, over the last few decades across the world, with people leaving rural areas and coming to cities, perhaps less so in the West, actually, other parts of the world. But I think those pull factors will still be there in terms of jobs, culture and all sorts of other things that draw people to cities. Will there be a bit of a downside? You know, people will see more of the downsides of that? Possibly, yeah. I really don't know, but I certainly enjoy living in the city, and I hope that you know, the good things about living in the city will come back to us, and we'll quickly want to tap into those again. You know, I think it would be a shame actually if people just thought, oh, I can't be near other people. That would be a really sad outcome to all of this, and I don't think it's a very sustainable way of living. I think cities are a sustainable model for housing large groups of people, and we don't want everyone to live in the middle of nowhere where they have to use a car, for example. But I agree with you that all sorts of things that we rely on for the city to operate, like public transport, at the moment seem highly unattractive, if not impossible.
So I kind of been interested in, I forget where the quote comes from, but someone talking about how we in the short term massively overestimate the consequences of something, but in the longer term massively underestimate them. And I guess the idea that, you know, a coronavirus may well peter out or will have gone, you know, within months or, you know, however long. But the idea that actually this problem with viruses, that we saw a little bit with Ebola, which was kind of managed, but other things are presumably going to come along that architects are going to have to start getting to grips with. The problem itself, this interconnected world, is presumably not going away, and how architects are going to start designing or changing designs based on that.
I mean, I think you're right that even if we defeat coronavirus comprehensively, we may have quite a different view of the threat of pandemic than we did before it arrived. And you're right that these things like SARS and Ebola you would read about, but they wouldn't affect you living here in England in the same way as coronavirus has, obviously. And I saw that people were talking about a TED talk that Bill Gates gave in 2005, I think it was, where he said, you know, we worry about these other kind of threats like terrorism, like the threat of nuclear war. And actually, the real threat we've got is from a virus, because we've thought about these other threats and we've invested in ways of minimizing those threats. You know, we've thought about how to minimize them and we've put in place measures that reduce the risk, but we haven't done anything really about the threat of virus. And I thought that was obviously a really sort of prophetic thing to say.
Yeah.
So, I think you could be right that everything that we produce, including the way we design buildings and cities, may be influenced by this realization that we are much more vulnerable to this than we'd thought before.
So we've gone a little bit off where I wanted to pull you back to journalism, really. And you did a degree in politics to start with. Was that, just talk us through your route into journalism.
Going quite a long way back. I suppose at school I really, really enjoyed history. So I kind of thought about doing history at university. But I'd worked out, I suppose, that political history was the bit that interested me the most. So, yeah, I did a degree in politics. I didn't really know what I wanted to do long term, although I was pretty sure I didn't want to be a politician, luckily. After I got a degree, I kind of mucked about for a while. I still didn't know what I wanted to do, but I thought probably something in the media. I did a few sort of worked in America for a bit, and on the London Eye, believe it or not, when the London Eye first opened, I was one of the capsule capsule hosts, who were the, you know, people were frightened about going on the capsule, so you had to have somebody sort of holding their hand and telling them they weren't going to die. And pointing out landmarks. So I did that, interestingly. And so,
look at this nice building that takes your mind off impending death.
Yeah, and saw Mark Sparfield up close when they were unveiling it, which was pretty cool. But that was just a kind of temporary job, obviously. And this is a very meandering way of answering your question, but I'm just thinking back. I suppose...
It's the routine. It's really...
I went into advertising initially and became a media planner, which are the people who kind of divvy up budgets for advertising campaigns, you know, online, cinema, billboards, etc., etc., sort of launches and stunts, that kind of thing, which was great in some ways. I enjoyed the parties, but I sort of quickly realised I wasn't quite sort of stimulated enough by that, I suppose. So then I did a postgrad degree in newspaper journalism, which was a kind of 5-month course. And then I got a job on a local paper for 18 months or so.
That's the...
Yeah, which is a sort of...
Harrow Observer.
That's right. Yeah, you've done your research. Yeah.
A particular interest of mine is just the importance of local media and local... In my early background was in politics and a lot of engagement with local newspapers and just the, like, how strongly... I mean, this was, 20 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, but how attached people felt to their local newspaper and the value of the local newspaper, and how the local newspaper was the only thing holding local, the local council or whatever to account.
Yeah.
And
I think
it strikes me that there's a similarity there between, local journalism and then coming into, work for the AJ.
Yeah, I think that's right. It was a very good grounding, and it's really a shame how much local papers have declined, as you say, obviously down to loss of advertising revenue and also people, I guess, being able to get their information about their local area in a different way through online forums and blogs and Facebook and all sorts of things like that. But you're right, I think, that holding councils and other local bodies to account is so much harder without that. And indeed, I think when I joined my local paper, it was already, starting to go into that sort of spiral of decline, sadly, which is perhaps why one of the reasons I'm interested in moving a little bit and going into something different. And I think working for a business title like the AJ, it was a good move actually in retrospect, because it does have a more sustainable kind of footing commercially, being a sort of subscription model that people, you know, they need that kind of information for their day-to-day working life. So
business intelligence.
Yeah, exactly. So
but you took that same investigative approach, didn't you, with you when you when you joined the AJ?
Yeah, I suppose I sort of wasn't afraid to ask questions and knock on doors and that sort of thing. And I hadn't done much investigative work, to be honest, at the Harrow Observer, but one or two, I'd sort of started to go in that direction a little bit, I suppose. And and I joined Building Design 2004 when Rob Booth was editor. So he went on to The Guardian, as you probably know, and was a very sort of tough editor, mainly in a good way. And so there was a team of reporters, you know, there was a bit more resource in those days for titles like AJ and BD. So there was a great rivalry between the two magazines, and we'd really fiendishly, you know, try and beat the other one every week and get the best front page we could that was going to, you know, that AJ would be unable to compete with. So yeah, it was fiercely competitive, and in some ways that was really, again, a really good grounding.
Tough then to jump ship from BD to AJ.
Yeah.
Just tell us about that process.
Yeah, I'd spent ages trying to, you know, trying to kill AJ almost. I kind of hadn't quite realised just how important their subscription model was going to be, because, as you know, BD was a freebie, and that... you know, obviously BD is still going as a website, but sadly that sort of put off print product, which was great, irreverent title that was kind of loved and hated in equal measure by the profession. And unfortunately, being a freebie, you know, it was very, very heavily reliant on advertising, classified ads.
Yeah.
And when that dried up, it was very, very difficult, of course, to go to the audience and say, hey, you know, this thing you've been getting, you know, that you enjoy and you've been getting free for the last 30 or 40 years, do you think you could now start paying us? It's a really, really hard position to come from, you know. And AJ had always been different, of course, because it was a paid subscription title. But
I mean, if architects think the competition is rife within the architecture profession, they've just got to see how journalists work, and that competition for scoops and for getting stories is... voracious.
Yeah, it's pretty full on. And I kind of, funnily enough, the route from BD and Building, which I worked for a bit as well, to AJ was that a former colleague, Rory Olgiato, had worked with me on BD and then became the acting editor of AJ and needed a deputy. So he rang me up and I kind of resisted for a while, and then I thought, actually, this could be quite good. So yeah, we worked together for a while on the AJ, and that's how that came about.
That, I guess, then brings it, talking then about investigative journalism. I guess one of the areas you've made your name, certainly in the broader national press, is around your investigative work into the Garden Bridge. Mm. That's been going on for, for what, 6 years, the investigation? I mean, there's two, I mean...
Yeah, it's hard to believe, really.
Yeah, there's two, things to kind of probe there, I guess. You know, one, as managing editor with a bit of an eye on the business of the paper, it's a lot of resources you're putting into one story, which you're doggedly following. How do you balance that, putting those resources in, like any business, limited limited staff resource that you've got, managing pretty heavy investment into a story with having to keep the ship afloat? Is that a challenge?
It's become more of a challenge, I would say. It's just, I suppose, there's a bit of an ebb and flow in how teams work, and I suppose when I started doing the Garden Bridge work, I probably had a bit more of my time to devote to editorial, and that's declined a bit in recent years. So I do have a bit less time for that. But I suppose I've always thought that if something is public interest journalism and you care about it sufficiently, there's a good chance that others will feel the same. And that proved to be the case with the Golden Bridge. You know, I think our audience came with us, really. The vast majority of the audience. Yeah, sure, there are people who probably thought, oh God, if I read another Golden Bridge article again, I'm going to shoot myself. But I think most of them were really, really interested and really believed in what we were doing. So, you know, then it takes on a bit of momentum and you think, this is worth devoting resource to. And if I had to do work in the evenings in order to get the stories done, I would do that. You know, I didn't necessarily consign myself to 9-to-5s if the story warranted it. You know, and I was sufficiently excited about the story when it was really taking on a life of its own that I was happy to do that.
Interesting how the story originally developed. I mean, what was the first kind of inkling that something wasn't quite right that got you poking around?
Obviously, the project was very, very high profile, given that it was championed by the mayor, Boris Johnson, and had a lot of celebrity backing with the designer Thomas Heatherwick and the sort of instigator of it, Joanna Lumley, and various other high-flying individuals also associated with it. So I think by the time I started really digging into it, there had been a fair amount of coverage already, and I think people, including Ollie Wainwright in The Guardian, had written about some of the early controversies. If you remember, there was controversy over how freely accessible the bridge would be. You know, the idea that a lot of people didn't seem to like that it would close at midnight and it wouldn't be a public right of way like you might expect a Thames crossing to be, and that there would be limits on the number of people in a group who could go over it, and there wouldn't be cycling as originally envisaged, etc., etc. So people had started to ask those kind of questions, but the question that I was originally asking was, how did Heatherwick come to design this project? Because it's being backed by public money. And I knew that, obviously, when you're spending significant amounts of public money, in this case, £60 million on the project, you definitely have to have a free and open tendering process. And I'd immediately sort of started to wonder about this because I knew that Heatherwick and Lumley had been a team, had worked on this project before Boris Johnson formally backed it. So I thought, how can a publicly elected mayor back a project like this without a tendering process? You know, it's presented to him on a plate, here's a bridge we've designed, you know, can you back it? But if you're putting public money into that, as I said, you have to have a competition. So I was sort of wondering about that, and then I found out that there had actually been an official competition. It hadn't been very well publicised, but obviously it had taken place with Mark Sparfield and Wilkinson Air going up against Heatherwick Studio. So immediately the question became, well, how fair was this contest? You know, was it really an open evaluation of who's the best person to design this bridge? Or was it some sort of charade where Heatherwick was always going to get the gig? So that got me asking these questions and putting in FOI requests.
And then I guess, you know, a little bit more recently, the GLA have, you know, been investigating. You had Boris Johnson, I think he was he still Foreign Secretary at the time, giving evidence to...
Yes, he was Foreign Secretary,
I forget quite what his... it'd be interesting to get your take on that, but also about, you know, holding the powerful to account.
At the hearing, as you say, where he was actually summoned to give evidence, which I think the first time a former mayor has been summoned in that way to give evidence, decided to say that, you know, the AJ had printed all these horrendous things about GLA or TfL officers and, you know, that we'd sort of cooked this up because we had some kind of, or I had a grudge against Thomas Heatherwick, some sort of personal grudge that would have made me write all these awful things about TfL officers. I mean, it didn't really stand up to, in any way, because obviously, if I had have had a grudge against Heatherwick, which I don't, I probably would have attacked him rather than blameless TFL officers. But, you know, I think at that point, Johnson was on the ropes and he had to throw the proverbial dead cat on the table, which he did. It was quite shocking because I was actually in the audience when he did this. And I regret not following him out of the chamber and remonstrating with him, to be honest.
So I guess we're going to struggle in such a short episode to cover the whole story. People can obviously read all of the coverage on the AJ website. Are there any other campaigns coming up? Be interesting just to say a little bit about some of the other campaigns.
Well, we're working on this Retro First campaign, which you may be aware of, which is all about reusing existing buildings. So obviously there's a long tradition in this country and other countries of preserving buildings for heritage value and architectural value. But this is really saying we need to preserve them for energy value, that the embodied carbon in these buildings is a really important part of the equation when it comes to fighting the climate emergency or responding to the climate emergency. You know, we can't go on with this wasteful cycle of knocking buildings down and starting again, because that's hugely energy efficient and inefficient. And I think architects, just like politicians and other parts of the built environment for that matter, have thought very much in recent years about operational carbon. So the, you know, how efficient can we make this building? Once it's got going, once the building's actually finished, how efficient can we make it? How airtight can we make it? How low can we get the energy usage? And what they've really not thought so much about is the production of that building.
Oh, I was going to say, I have a question, partly for my own interest, which is, I remember campaigning on this issue for years, since I worked probably 20 years ago at the Civic Trust in its old form, before it was lost. And the major issue then, and as I understand it, kind of really continues to be, is the VAT payments and the difference. And I wondered if you were envisioning a campaign specifically on that at any point.
Well, the VAT is one of our sort of three planks, I suppose. So we've got three main demands of government, and we haven't formally submitted to government. We've been gathering industry support ahead of doing that. But we will obviously submit to government in the coming months. And as I said, there are three main sort of demands of government. And the first of them, as you rightly point out, is taxation. So tackling the discrepancy between VAT on new build, which is typically 0 or 5%, and refurbishment, which is typically 20%, that's entirely the wrong way round. So at the very least, we'd like to see some equalisation of that. The other two demands concern, first of all, policy. So that's how could we amend the planning guidance, things like the MPPF, and also potentially the building regs, in order to just keep reminding people through the development cycle that they should think twice before demolishing, making it more difficult. I think in a conservation area, you have to get planning permission to demolish. So one of the things we've explored is, could you apply that across the board so that everyone has to get planning permission before demolishing a building? And then the third one is about procurement. So the idea that, because obviously the public sector has a large estate and is a large client for construction projects, that they should really lead by example and practice refurbishment and retrofit ahead of other things. And that, we think, could stimulate the private sector as well, because you'd start to stimulate the right skills and the right businesses that could also operate in the private sector as well as the public sector.
We've taken your much more than the half an hour I promised you would.
Interesting.
No, it's a really good conversation. Yeah. Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Next issue of the AJ comes out week after next. Have you got a cover story yet?
Culture is the theme of the next issue, but as I was saying, that the coronavirus is also a kind of very big theme of our coverage, unsurprisingly, at the moment.
How people are adapting.
And online we're doing, which may make it into the print issue, we're doing a number of guides, I suppose, survival guides in different areas for how architects can get through this in a business sense. Because obviously the government's announced all sorts of unprecedented measures, as you'll be aware, for both businesses and sole practitioners or freelancers.
Great. Well, we look forward to reading that. I don't know if we'll get our issue get sent to our office, so we'll have to work out how to. You're probably going to get inundated with requests to have postal addresses changed and people arguing in the office who gets the copy sent to their house or who.
We're going to go out to the audience and suggest that they may wish to change the delivery address. So yes, I fear the print the print issue will be a bit less red than usual.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Will.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks for having me.
I'm Owen Wainhouse.
And I'm Tamsie Thompson.
Thanks for listening.